kpi.org. Good evening. Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Mason engineers this particular episode, or somebody's engineering it. I am at home doing this. I want to start out by letting your listeners know that this is Pledge Drive, and we do value your support and need your support. This show has been around for over 25 years. That's almost as old as me, by the way. And that's a long time to bring insights into and ideas about and educate the public. And that's what we pride ourselves on doing. So I know you value this show because I get your emails and I get your comments. Please donate and show us your financial support. You can go to kfai.org, a safe and secure website, and do that. Or you can call 612-375-9030. We are listening to some of the great shows that we have done here in the past year or so to kind of remind you that we are here and needing your financial support, 612-375-9030 or kfai.org. We bring you this show each week, and I have a lot of fun doing a lot of these shows. And this one, I think, shows a lot that how much fun I did have. I was interviewing Dr. Raja Kandaswamy, who is a professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And he was talking about a solid organ transplant. And this was a really fun show for me to do, but also vitally important for the time that we're living in and have been living in for the past couple years. So it's really important to know about these things, and we value the people who bring us this information so we can bring it to you. You can call 612-375-9030 or kfai.org. And here we go. Let's listening to some things about organ transplant. Can you tell us currently how many organs can be transplanted?
Well, there are various organs in the body that can be transplanted. The most common, of course, is kidney transplants, and that's the most commonly performed transplants, followed by liver transplants. So those two probably predominate. Other transplants that are performed are pancreas, small intestines, heart, lungs, and also more recently, uterus transplants, which have been performed.
Really?
Yes.
In addition, I did not know that.
Yes, that's been done. It's not very common, but it's been done in a few selected centers, and we have an interest in it as well. The other transplants that are done are vascularized composite allografts. I'll tell you what I mean by that. Those belong to tissues that come along with their own blood supply, and those include hand transplants for people who may have lost their hands due to accidents and trauma. And the second is face transplants. So those are other types of transplants that are being performed.
I think that's fascinating. I'm just curious, how successful are the uterus transplants?
The uterus transplants are a transitory transplant, if you will. They have a very defined purpose: to provide a childbearing option,
right,
a biological childbearing option for the mother.
Right.
And so the need for long-term success is not as important for uterus transplant. It has to take you, first of all, it has to be technically successful in that the operation has to go well, the blood supply and things have to connect okay, and the uterus has to thrive. Secondly, it has to get the ability to get pregnant. And thirdly, has to be able to bear a full-term pregnancy. And once that's done, then the uterus can be removed, basically. So it's only done in a handful of cases so far in the United States. And there's been the Swedish are the pioneers in that. So I think there's a small, it's a small start, but there's a potential for it to grow in the future. It all depends on competing technologies as well as to in vitro fertilization and now surrogate motherhood. And it's a whole area. We look at the biology of uterine transplants and concentrate on whether or not we can make it work.
That is fascinating. All right. Well, we got a whole lot to get to, so I can't concentrate too much on this, but at some point that would be a fascinating topic. So what are the organs that can be donated without someone having to be a dead donor and donating them? I know kidney is one, theoretically liver too, right?
Yes. You touch upon an important classification of organ donors. There's a
yes.
One is a living organ donor versus a deceased organ donor. If you're talking about living donation, which is what we'll discuss first, a healthy volunteer can donate one kidney, since we have two kidneys. At least the majority of us, or the great majority of us, are blessed with two functioning kidneys, and so are perfectly capable of functioning with one kidney for the rest of our lives. So we could give one up, and that's the most commonly performed living donor transplant. As far as liver, there's only one liver, but fortunately that's the largest organ in the body outside of the skin. And therefore there is enough reserve in the liver to be able to give up to one half of the liver or even a little bit more if required, if you're a healthy donor. So a partial liver donation can be performed and it's being performed in the country with fair regularity. And it's a bigger operation for the donor than a kidney, but it's certainly doable. The third organ that's performed is a pancreas transplant. Pancreas is done in cases where someone has advanced diabetes and has problems with diabetic control. Often it's combined with a kidney transplant, because diabetes is one of the leading causes of kidney failure. So again, we're only blessed with one pancreas, therefore it'll have to be a partial pancreas transplant. And that's been performed less commonly. Intestine, a portion of the intestine has been donated and has been performed here at the University of Minnesota and a couple of other centers. And finally, lung. You could certainly give a lobe of the lung from a living donor and be able to utilize two living donors, in fact, to make a lung recipient well from chronic lung failure. So those are the organs where living donation has been utilized and have been successful.
I presume that there is a partial amount of our listeners who might be kind of freaking out as opposed to the thought of giving their liver and whatnot. But my understanding is that the liver can grow back, regenerate. So yes,
the liver has an amazing capacity to regenerate. In extreme cases, the liver can regenerate after losing 85% of its volume, which is an extreme example. Of course, we would not be pushing those kind of limits in healthy donors, but most donors can give up safely 60% of their liver, and the other 40% will gradually grow back and compensate to provide 100% of the function that the body needs.
Yeah. And so when you do the liver transplant, are you taking exactly half of the liver or only less than that?
So there's a variety of considerations. In a adult to child transplant, for example, where the mother or father donates to a baby or a young kid, you probably do not need to take anywhere close to one half. So the liver is divided into eight segments, if you will, one through eight. And we can just take two segments of the eight and do a baby transplant with that from an adult. From when you transplant from one adult to another, you may need more than two segments, and usually it's one half of the liver. And one half of the liver is not exactly a half because the right lobe is larger than the left. So if you do if you take the right half of the liver, you're taking probably about 60% of the liver. And if you take the left half of the liver, you're taking about 40%. Which one we take will depend on the recipient and donor size matching, the suitability of the donor to be able to donate 60% of their liver, and a variety of other factors. So yes, up to 60%, but yes, many cases lower.
And so when you do that, then presumably, as you said, the liver can start regenerating. Will it make like it's the new part be like it's a whole new liver, or is it regenerating from what you already have? And if you already have an older liver, you're going to get an older liver regenerating?
It's not like the liver is adding new. Let's say you... you downsized from I don't know what a good analogy would be, but you downsized from a liver that's 1.5 grams down to 1 gram. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I say, I mean 1,500 grams to 1,000 grams.
Okay.
What can happen within 2 to 3 months is that liver that's now downsized to 1,000 grows back up to 1,500 and sometimes even more. It doesn't form a new, the cells hypertrophy, meaning they proliferate and they get more functional and can compensate for the rest of the missing liver. Now, it doesn't form any new blood vessels. The basic anatomical structures remain the same. It just gets to be larger to be able to accommodate the function.
This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org, also at 612-375-9030. You probably can hear my dog in the background chewing on her elk antler. I'm lucky enough to be able to do this from home and have still bring to you really important things that I think the disability community values. And in order to do that, we do need your support. Please give us your financial support and show us that you are out there, as we know you are. 612-375-9030 or kfai.org. This is another awesome interview I really enjoyed doing with Linda Fodrini Johnson. She brought us her book called The Empowered Caregiver, and it talks all about how to plan when you're older and need to make those important decisions, or even as a family member, how to approach a parent or loved one or anybody who is getting into the less stable part of their lives sometimes, or just want to make sure that they do have a secure ending. And so she's talking a lot about that. Let's listen to her as you show us your support by going to kfai.org. This is not really your first rodeo. I saw you wrote another book, I believe, on aging.
It's just a little short thing. Yes. Yeah.
Why did you feel like a book like this was needed?
Thank you for asking that. The original title that I came up with, you know, you talk to an editor and they make you change that, was a pocket support group for family caregivers. And I've been doing support groups besides doing one-on-one counseling and lots of care plans and what I call roadmaps for families. Mm-hmm. I thought not everyone has the time to take for a support group. They're too busy with their caring,
yep,
or dividing family care and parent care and maybe spousal care and,
right,
you know, all the generations of care that they're doing, mostly women. So a pocket support group, something that you could pick up as a resource and not have to read it from cover to cover, which I do recommend, but you don't have to. You could just go to the chapter that's causing you some distress and read it and say, oh, there's a solution. So the concept of the book is Every chapter I write the issue in probably 4 to 6 sentences at the most. Mm-hmm. Then I get right into strategies and examples. And sometimes there's lists and checklists, but not too many. And then there's an affirmation on every chapter to help people remember what they just read and keep them more positive, focused mm-hmm. on the needs of caregiving. And, you know, again, so many caregivers that I've worked with have had serious illnesses themselves, either, you know, things like aneurysms and strokes and heart attacks before the person they were caring for passed away or were placed because they're overcaring. Mm. So I thought the book would empower caregivers with the information they needed to have a balance in their life between caregiving and self-care. You know, it's an opportunity and a service of love to care for somebody in our family. But if we do it and ignore ourselves, we're not providing good care actually for our family member, nor are we taking care of our own health. So that's kind of what's behind the book. And I just recently did a talk with a Parkinson's group, and the people on that podcast that I was talking with said, and talking with me and listening to how the book is constructed, that they felt heard. So the book is not just about the person that's the caregiver. The book is really for all of us, because on this journey we all call life, mm-hmm. we are going to have some potholes we're going to mm-hmm. fall into it. Yes. If we live a long life, for sure. And if we live a shorter life, we fall into those potholes prematurely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to start off, because you start off with your first chapter that is, I think, a valuable one, called basically Caregiving Basics. And there's a lot in there, even though I think you did do a great job of abridging kind of what you needed to do and the things that everyone should really know. And but there's a lot to talk about. And you mentioned starting the conversation and the importance of this with the loved person that you are caring for. Talk a little bit about that. That strategy. Yes.
So when most adult children or people with aging family members, it could be anybody. It could be your mm-hmm. sister, your brother, your mother, your father, your grandparent, want to say you should. You need to get a caregiver. You should move to assisted living. They're doing a lot of that. And that's not usually successful. So setting up that conversation in the beginning is using an iMessage, which many of us have learned at some point across our educational life spectrum. But it's saying, I'm concerned about you, Mom and Dad. Can we have a talk about your wishes as you age and what you want or don't want? And I always suggest that not happen. We're facing the holidays right now. So listeners, don't do this on Thanksgiving Day.
A very wise suggestion.
Yeah. The day after, if everybody is gathered, that might be a good time. And no alcohol, no food, just a conversation. Everybody have a cup of tea or coffee or whatever. Mm. But, you know, and sit around and talk with your older family member about what they want if they had a crisis. Now, maybe you already have enough red flags that they need help, but don't go there right now. Just talk about the what ifs. What if you broke your hip or Mom wasn't here to help you anymore, Dad? You know, if Mom's been the helper, what would you want? Do you want to stay in your own home with some assistance, or do you want to move to one of those really nice assisted livings that have everything from horseback riding to, you know, tours and trips and travel and just all kinds of things?
So in general, how easy does this tend to be for people to do, and how receptive are their people they're caring for usually?
Okay, I think it's about 50% receptive and 50%. I don't need to burden you with that. We've taken care of everything. So it's a resistance. And there is, oh, thank God, I was worried about that. So I want to talk about that, but I didn't want to burden your kids. But if you want to talk about it, yeah, I'd rather move closer to one of you if something happened to Dad. And the conversation goes a lot smoother. You get more resistance if there's a dementia element. That the person isn't able to see that they have needs, and you're going to get resistance. So your strategy is going to be a little bit different. And sometimes you're going to have to use, which I talk about in the book, therapeutic fiblets. Mm. If somebody is more advanced in their dementia and they're a danger to yourself or others living alone, then you have to take some action.
You know, you give lists, like you said, they're usually pretty good lists, and they're not very, very much, except that you did this list of several things that you should make sure you know about the situation, like insurance and medicine, et cetera. There were just several things. And I found not only did that kind of make my head spin thinking of that if I were a caregiver, but that I probably don't have that list written down myself and probably should do that just to make sure. So talk about some of those things that you list in the book that the caregiver really needs to make sure they know.
Yeah, you need to know where your parents' finances come from. How are they automatically deposited? Do they come in a check form? Do mom and dad deposit them every month? Who has access to those checking accounts? Do mom and dad have they done some legal planning? Do they have a trust? Do they have those advanced healthcare directives? A lot of people say, yes, I have them, but they haven't really signed them or completed them. They have the piece of paper, but they don't have them completed. So you the legal documents, the financial documents, where the money comes from, what might they be entitled to? Maybe they are low or middle income people, mm-hmm. and they might be entitled to things they're not taking advantage of. So you kind of want to know. A lot of times older adults don't want to talk finances with their children. They're very closed about that. But sometimes when you open the door with, you know, mom or dad, there might be entitlements that you're missing out on. Let's go to a website and check it out and see if there might be some other sources for your support. So again, when you say that there might be something that's like free money or something that's going to help them, they're more cooperative. Mm. So again, you want to know, are they entitled to the VA benefit? Is one of the things that a lot of people don't know about, aid and attendant benefit. So, you know, they go to benefits, it's benefitscheckup.org, and put in their information and they'll find, you know, what they're entitled to or not entitled to.
You also, and that goes, go ahead.
And that's a broad range of entitlements. Mm. When I put my own information on in it, it came out, I said, I'm not going to be entitled to anything. It said I was entitled to a pass to the national parks.
Oh, wow.
So it's really broad.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you're entitled to. So there's the entitlements. And then there are definitely medications, doctors, hospitals that they use, the name of a neighbor. Do they have a go bag in case of an emergency, anything from, you know, fires to earthquakes to hurricanes to, we don't know what kind of dilemma could beset a community.
COVID.
So do they have that? Yeah, COVID. Yeah, pretty, besides getting a vaccination, it's pretty hard to avoid that. Mm. And even that, then you still have to be careful. So all of these things, I mean, and I have even more in the book that you need to have. And if you have that information, then when there's a crisis, there is the broken hip. If your parents haven't planned to move someplace and you live at a distance, you have that information. You could fax it or download it and get it to an emergency room, especially if you are the person that's going to help make decisions. So the more information you have, the easier it is for an emergency team to assist your parent in a crisis.
KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. We are walking down memory lane listening to some awesome interviews that we've done in the past year or two, which has really been kind of a crazy couple years for everyone, I think. This next person that I will be speaking with is Chris Stark, and Chris writes really thought-provoking books, and they are ones that are, they're not an easy read. They make you think, they make you ask questions, they can even make you angry, but it's all about stirring up the emotions and bringing them to you and showing you what is really happening in the world, which I feel like KFAI does. So show us your financial support. We really love to hear from you and we need that to keep going, and you can do that by going to kfai.org or by calling 612-375-9030. Chris is an author, and she wrote her book, their latest one called Carnival Lights, which is talks about trafficking or Native American people, really how they have struggled through their journeys and still are struggling, and about the several different topics that many people are not aware of. So let's take a listen to this, and please show us your support by going to kfai.org. This, too, was a fairly intense reading that I did of your book. Probably not as hard for me as Nichols was, but still an equally, I think, important topic. Set the stage for me about your book.
So the forward story about the two Ojibwe teenage girl cousins, Sharon Chris,
yeah,
is set in 1969 in Minnesota. And it follows them just over the course of a few weeks in the summer of 1969 as they leave a fictitious northern Minnesota reservation to come to Minneapolis. And then there's a lot of backstory that's intertwined about their family, about the reservation system, here in Minnesota. And then it also branches off into other aspects, historical aspects of Minnesota. It's partially historical fiction. So I guess it is historical fiction. And there are some historical facts and figures that are in the book that just kind of fit in perfectly with the story. So a lot of it is about identity. Mm-hmm. Not just Native identity, but also what we now call white identity, which of course, you know, 75-100 years ago was quite different than how quote unquote white people are perceived in this country. There was, you know, ethnic differences, there was, you know, great religious divides, and also people were still speaking the languages of the European countries that they came from or had very intense cultural ties with their European, mother country, or, you know, whatever they might call it. So it's about a lot of different issues. And the whole book is set in Minnesota.
Mm. You know, I notice you have a lot of history Minnesota, yes, but the lakes and the reservation and how things changed. That's true history, I presume.
Yeah. There's a significant amount of true history, and I kind of tagged it intuitive research. I'm actually an academic. I write academic articles, and I've done academic research. Mm-hmm. And this kind of research, I would say, was intuitive research. I would be like, I know this one piece of information about this part of the story. I know that family's Finnish, but I don't know anything else about them yet.
Uh-huh.
And then I would do a little bit of research, and it would just like pop out at me and just fit in really nicely with the fictional story. So it was really an interesting process for me to write this book, to blend those ways. Was really a lot of fun. And also it was satisfying in the sense that I think that white supremacy in Minnesota, these roots need to be examined, and they really need to be brought forward so that we can all, you know, heal from that and bring about justice and healing in this state, in this country.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm sure it's not just this state, as we will talk about later. How long did it take for you to write this book?
I actually started this book 20 years ago when I was a graduate student at the University of Central Florida. And our professor had us write a little like 7 or 10 page imitation of Cormac McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses. And these two characters, they just like jumped on the page, and there they were, and they came with their names and everything.
Wow.
And so my professor took me aside after he read it, and he said, "You have a responsibility to these characters to finish this, turn it into a book." And I remember thinking at the
of
time,
of course he did.
You know, I can't write a book. Like, but I always carried that sense of responsibility. I think this book has its own reasons, and the story has its own reason and purpose. And I think this is just when it needed to come out.
Talk about, you know, what gave you an interest in this particular story, you know, for writing a story like this. What made you feel like you had to do it?
Well, I think partly my feeling is that the story came to me, and I felt responsible, and I felt tasked in a sense to write it. And you know, this is a story of my family. Mm-hmm. This is a story of my community. This is a story of my ancestors. And I don't mean that, you know, in an absolute literal, you know, this is obviously a fictional piece, but it's written out of that spirit. And, you know, I think a lot of times readers might not understand how much truth is in fiction. And they'll be like, well, I don't want to read that. It's not real. It's fiction. I want to read nonfiction. But when we're writing nonfiction, we're doing a lot more censoring, and you know, making maybe ourselves look a little better or whatever,
right?
Or not saying something. But with fiction, you've got a green light, and so this story is, you know, this story is, it's about my past too. It's about my community's past.
You talk in the book about fear of the police, and in Carnival Lights, and this is bothersome to me. And it's not just in regards to the Native culture. You know, I think a lot of other cultures, the African American culture, many other cultures experience fear of the police. And this is sad to me because they're supposed to be the protectors, right? They are supposed to be the ones that look over you, watch out for you, and protect you. But constantly, these two main characters, Shira and Kristen, are terrified of them in some ways, in many ways. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I don't speak for, you know.
Is that a true feeling though in the Native community?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's absolutely my feeling too. I think there's a lot of fear of the police. There's a lot of and it's not just that it's something that's in our head, you know, and we need to get over.
Yes.
It's because the police have been complicit or actual perpetrators. Not every police officer, obviously I'm not saying that, but, as an institution, unfortunately, you know, it has had a, often a very negative impact, on the Native community, especially when you're talking about homeless Native people, especially when you're talking about sexually abused, sex trafficked people in general, and then, you know, also particularly Native folks as well. And again, I'm not saying that every police officer is bad or any, you know, that's not what I'm saying, but institutionally, that unfortunately has been the way that it has largely played out in our communities.
Well, you can find, unfortunately, you can find people's real videos all the time about how the police are failing in public. And
yeah,
I am hopeful that this will change, but it does feel surprisingly terrifying. And if people don't realize, or if they think they're totally safe and it can never happen to you just because you're white, I really don't think that that's true. And think that it will probably happen less, but you still need to be aware of what's going on. That it's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've never considered the police to be something that would protect me or that would do anything positive for me. You know, personally, I've never experienced that feeling. And I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but I mean, I'm just, you know, that's just where I'm coming from.
I want to talk about Kristen. She goes through many changes, various changes when she's in the church bathroom. What happens there? Is she just really like looking back on things, or is she having difficulties mentally?
Yeah. So, Chris or Kristen, she goes by both names in the book. Mm-hmm. Her father abused her and abused and did some things to her mother as well when she was very young. Mm-hmm. And she, the book exemplifies how she carries that forward, how she survives that. And her cousin Chris, like, will comment on occasion, you know, like she sees Chris going in. Did I say her cousin Chris? Her cousin,
yeah.
Cher.
Yeah.
Her cousin Cher comments on occasion about how she will see sort of this chain come over Chris. Mm-hmm. And she calls her little Chris. And so I don't want to give away the, you know, some of the story here.
Right.
So I'll just say that, you know, she was very young when her father was, you know, harming her and her mother. And then that continued on until she left. And when people carry that, and it comes out in a variety of ways. And with her, it's sometimes it's like a regression where she turns into a much younger, you know, part or aspect of herself. Mm-hmm. And sometimes she's kind of cycling through, like Jacob, you know, also in the book, a gay teenage Jewish boy that they meet up with in Minneapolis. They will kind of cycle through some of their trauma. And with his, you know, he's also got a lot of drug abuse that's going on with that.
Yes.
But it's a cycling through of the harm and the different, you know, sometimes people can develop these, what they call dissociation, you know, these states where you know, you're a different age, or you might even be a different, you know, somebody, some part of you that adopted a different name in order to survive whatever trauma you went through.
So in the sense, it didn't happen to them. It happened to somebody else.
Right. Yep. Exactly. It's a skillful coping mechanism. And, the dominant culture in the U.S., you know, looks at it as a pathology, and it's actually called a disorder. And I was talking to my Wet'en, Earl Hoagland, once about it. Wet'en in the Ojibwe way, he's kind of like a godparent.
Uh-huh.
He was he's passed now, but he was a Indian doctor, a spiritual person. And, you know, he said, oh, what are they saying now? And so I explained to him what that meant. And he said, oh, that's a gift from the spirits.
Oh.
He said, I had to walk all over Canada and the US to learn those ways. And so, you know, I think it's just, that's one of obviously the major themes in the book, right?
Yes.
Are these cultural differences between, in this, you know, particular book, the Ojibwe traditions and then, you know, the dominant white culture that we all exist in. Mm.
Yes. And also how they pass on, you know, their culture and their history where and what they choose to pass on. Right. Mm-hmm. Not always everything. They pass on what they feel seems like strength, what they can make their children stronger.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's something that happens over and over again in the book. And, you know, sometimes people will be like, oh, this book was really about there's abuse happening in it. There's homelessness in this. But to me, the book is like really like the backbone of this book is just the love. Mm-hmm. And the cultural traditions and strength of the Ojibwe to be able to survive what our ancestors survived and what, frankly, we're still surviving in many ways right now. Those ways I think are very evident in the book. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting those kinds of teachings from my grandmothers. You couldn't talk about it specifically or, you know, outwardly, but you made those teachings evident by how you lived and the ways that you treated people. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot of that from my grandmothers, and I'm very, very thankful for that. They were models for me that were very different from some of the other people in my life who were, you know, very violent and destructive. And I could survive that because I had my grandmothers in my life to show me another way to model that for me. And so there's a lot of that happening in the book. And, you know, a lot of people aren't aware that Indigenous religious ways or spiritual ways, mm-hmm. our ceremonies, were outlawed in the United States of America until 1978. It was illegal to practice our traditions and our cultures in this country until 1978.
The land of religious freedom, huh?
Yep. Yeah.
Unreal. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. This is Disability and Progress. My name is Sam. We're speaking with Andy Strisik. Andy's customer service manager for Metro Mobility. So there's a lot of rides that get made through Metro Mobility, and there's now more than one different way to make a ride. Can you go through the different ways and how people can schedule a ride and how that's done?
Yeah, we have a number of them. Certainly still by far the most popular way and the classic way is to do so by phone. When someone is certified, they will get a temporary Metro Mobility card that has the phone number of their particular provider on it. We kind of split our service area into three chunks, one Western, which is kind of Minneapolis and the Western suburbs. One Eastern, St. Paul, and the East suburbs, plus up into like Anoka County. And then the Southern area, which is Bloomington and Richfield on south into Dakota County. And each of these has, you know, is held by three different contracts, three different phone numbers, three different staffs, and calling is still the way the vast majority of bookings are made. However, it is not the only way, as you pointed out. We have an extremely small number of folks for whom it works best to fax. And you can do that at each of the providers. We still require that they have the old relic, the TTY. So you can use a TTY still to book a ride at the providers. And then you can email, which is gaining popularity. You can fire off an email to book a ride. And then finally, another way that is back and increasing in popularity is the online booking app. If you go to metromobility.org under the scheduling header and the book your trip online button that's within the scheduling header, then you can book a trip yourself online without interacting with a reservationist at all. However, before you do that, you do need to call my staff at 651-602-1111 just get set up with a password.
You talked about the Metro Mobility app. I think that's happening more and more in regards to having apps to schedule things. Where does one find that and how does that work?
Well, the Metro Mobility online booking app is set up to be mobile site friendly, so it functions like an app, but it really is it's a website. It is within our website. So if you go to metromobilityagain.org, go to that scheduling trips section, and then within the scheduling trips section, there'll be a book your trip online. You just click that and you'll be right at the online trip booking site for the core Metro Mobility service.
Now, I want to point out that I think, if I'm correct, that if you're going to book a ride like that, it has to line up as far as the times that you're trying to book, not that you're asking for, but the time when you go to make the ride, it has to be during Metro Mobility service hours, right? Like from 6 to 5 or whatever, right? You can't go schedule a ride after 5, right?
You can do that for days that are not the next day. If you wanted to book a ride today for Saturday, and you can book rides for Metro Mobility up to 4 days in advance. So on a Thursday, you could book a ride for a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. And you could call, or go online rather right now and book a ride for Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. However, you could not do it for Friday because reservations is closed, and we didn't want to give, unfair advantage to folks who have the means to afford a computer. Somebody who does not have a computer for whatever reason can no longer book a ride for the next day after 5 p.m. And we wanted to make sure that that was also the case for folks who did have internet access.
Gotcha. During the pandemic, you did something that I thought was really awesome, and it was called curb-to-curb service. Talk about what that is and how does it work, and do we still have it, and are we keeping it?
Yeah. The curbside service, as we kind of named it, was a response to the pandemic and specifically a response to the early days of the COVID-19 outbreak, where some dispensaries and drugstores even and banks were closing their stores, not letting people come inside, but were allowing them to pull up and pick something up, use the ATM in the case of a bank, or just come and grab a script in the case of a pharmacy or dispensary. And in response to that, we kind of altered how Metro Mobility does things in those cases. Mm-hmm. Typically, each one-way trip for Metro Mobility is a separate ride on a separate bus with a separate driver, both of which need to be booked at least 1 day in advance. We don't do a will call type thing.
Right.
You've got to book your ride at least the day before and say what time either you want to get picked up at your starting point or what time you want to be at your destination. And then again, what time you want to get picked up at that destination and brought back to your point of origin. So what we changed is we said, basically, you can have up to 20 minutes where you're still paying two different fares and it still counts as two different rides. But that bus will just wait for you curbside, where if you call and book a curbside ride, that bus will pick you up, bring you to wherever you're going, and wait for you up to 20 minutes. And that has been, I think, a real success. think customers have liked that convenience, particularly for just real short trips, if they just needed to run in and grab something quick, not just in those examples that we gave, but in any number of situations where you really just needed 30 seconds or a couple of minutes or anything up to 20 minutes to run in and take care of something real quickly to save on the hassle of having to wait for another bus. And on the contractor side of things, it was nice for them not to have to try to find another bus that would fit for the return trip and route that. Mm. So it's not without its advantages also for the contractor. Seemed like a win-win as long as it was used sparingly. And we've got a very savvy ridership. And what did happen in some cases is we had customers booking a chain of curbside rides to essentially commandeer a bus for an entire day. And we, you know, clearly can't do that. So what we did is we started to limit curbside rides to one per customer per day, one round trip.
Okay.
Or it doesn't necessarily have to be a round trip, but one ride where the bus will wait for you one time at the curb for up to 20 minutes. And as long as customers can keep it to that, we do have hopes that that's going to be sustainable, even post-pandemic. We are still doing it now. We are doing it on a pilot basis, hoping to continue to do that indefinitely into the future.
And is it monetarily beneficial for the providers?
Not necessarily, but perhaps, you know, they're not having to spend the time trying to find another home for that return ride. They're not having to spend the time trying to physically, you know, move that booking onto the bus and those types of things. But a bus is sitting idle for up to 20 minutes too, that could otherwise be in use. So there are monetary advantages and monetary disadvantages potentially. And I think it depends on the particular case to say whether or not, you know, that's of a financial benefit to the provider. What I can say is all things considered, it is never a substantial detriment, that as long as we're limiting it to one a day, it's really, not ever a substantial detriment compared to sending a second bus.
So Andy, besides the great curbsides and Metro Mobility making ride system, there is something that does happen called same day. Can you explain how that works?
Sure. ADA paratransit really is designed to be, you know, shared ride public transit. So yeah, we're picking you up right at where you're starting from and dropping you off right at wherever you're going. But in between there, we're picking up and dropping off other people too, just like other forms of city busing do. Also, a function inherent to ADA paratransit is that you've got to book the ride at least one day in advance. But we recognize that for some folks, shared ride transportation just doesn't work well for whatever reason. And there are times when needing to book a ride one day in advance doesn't avail itself to spontaneity or emergencies that might pop up. So to kind of address those things, we have partnered with a cab company, Taxi Services, Inc., to provide a premium same-day service, which is just a private taxi cab. Does not have the same escort rules or anything. It is just your typical cab ride like anybody might take with or without a disability. But Metro Mobility subsidizes some of that fare. How it works is the customer pays the first $5 of the metered fare, and then Metro Mobility pays up to the next $15 of that fare. And then the customer is back on the hook for anything over that.
So if my ride's $30, I pay for the first $5, you pay for the next $15, and then I pay for the rest of the $30 after.
Yeah.
All right. There is an app, though, that works pretty nifty with this. Talk about that.
Sure. Similar to the way that you can go to metromobility.org and book your Metro Mobility trip online. There is a wide hailing service called iHail, which is an imprint of Taxi Services, Inc. And it basically makes it function sort of like a transportation networking company, like an Uber or a Lyft. You can rate your driver, but obviously you can book your ride, tell where the cab is as it's on its way to you, and those types of things. That is available for Android devices and iOS devices, and it's just called iHail. I and then hail, like hail a taxi, H-A-I-L. I should point out, too, that for folks who want to use it on a desktop, you can also do that rather than having it just be on a device. And to access it on a computer, you can go to eride.tplusride, T for transportation, plus ride.com/iHail.
Is the iHail app in the App Store?
Yes.
So one of the neat things I think now is that when you're booking your ride, you can see where the Metro Mobility or where the cab is, you know, the same day cab, which is a discount cab pretty much, but you can see where that is, how far that is from you. So if they're just 2 miles away, it might say 2 miles or 5 minutes or something like that. So it gives you a timeline to kind of work with, you know, because stuff happens. You need to go use the little girl's room, or you need to grab a drink of water, or your kid all of a sudden took their shoe off and you are frantically searching for it. So many things can happen. And so it gives you an idea of where that ride is so that you can be more properly prepared. We want to thank you for listening and joining me going down memory lane. I have always enjoyed doing these interviews for so long now, and I hope you're enjoying them. If you're listening, you must be. So I need you to join me in doing financial support for KFEI. Yes, even we give our financial support. It's interesting because I always think of this as giving to the community, as doing this. And so I feel like I'm giving to you. Now I'm asking you to give to us your financial support and your time by calling 612-375-9030 or going to kfai.org and giving us your support, showing us that you value this program and sharing your comments. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFEI or its board of directors, but I think tonight they are. Please feel free to call us at 612-375-9030 or going to kfei.org to show your support. We always value you. And in times of your support, we need you, of course. Thanks for listening. Good night. KFEI.org.